We're really excited to have you here, Phil.
Well, it's a pleasure being here with you. Been looking forward to it for a long time.
Yep, we've been too, and I'm sure a lot of our fans are too. Okay, our first question is, when did you decide to be a writer?
Well, I've been a writer for a long time. I started out as an actor, and but I always wrote a lot of my own material. So it was just, I think, having the courage to say, you know what, I'm now going to not only write for me, but I'm going to write for other people. I decided I wanted to be a writer a long, long time ago because I didn't just want to say other people's words. I wanted to be able to say my own words as well and have my own ideas out there. So it was kind of a concurrent thing, even though what I really wanted to do at first was act. It was always in the back of my mind to always be a writer as well. My dad really wanted to write. He always influenced me. He never published anything, but he would spend hours in his study and in his office, just clacking away at an old typewriter, trying to write a family history. That was his long goal. He never really actually did it, but he really wanted to try to write a family history. So it was pretty young. I was influenced pretty young.
Caitlin asks, in your career, who has influenced you the most and been an inspiration to you, besides God?
I was always influenced by comedians, to be quite honest with you. That was always a lot of that was always they were always my bigger influences. I really liked the Marx Brothers. Groucho Marx and Harpo Marx were big influences on me. I always liked the classic comedians. But as far as writing is concerned, I was very influenced by a guy named Paddy Chayefsky, especially when it came to writing Adventures in Odyssey. Paddy Chayefsky was a great writer of early television. And he also wrote several movies. And Paddy Chayefsky used to, before he would ever start writing something, he would research it to death, which is a pattern that I have followed in my career a lot. He wrote a movie called Network, and he actually wrote the whole history of the network before he ever wrote a piece of dialogue or any part of the story. He wrote the whole history of the network, how it was founded, and who was the major players in it. He also wrote a movie called The Hospital, and it was the same kind of thing. He wrote all about the hospital and who was in it and who, you know, all major players. So that was part of my influence. Another big influence, as anybody who knows me will tell you, is Star Trek. I was very influenced by the original Star Trek, and then later on by the Next Generation. Although the Next Generation started exactly the same time that we started Adventures in Odyssey, so it was kind of funny that those two things worked together. It was weird because we kind of came up with the same things in Odyssey, as far as like our imagination station, and Star Trek came up with the holodeck at the same time, and so it was kind of a strange thing, but. But the early Star Trek episodes and even some of the movies influenced me a great deal. It really made me want to become a writer. I really liked science fiction writing and the idea of fantasy writing and the idea of creating a world. So I was very influenced by that, by Gene Roddenberry, what he had done with the future world that he created in Star Trek. So, yeah, I owe a lot to those guys.
Yeah, I guess it really influenced you because later you spoofed Star Trek and Hidden in My Heart.
Right. I don't know that that was me. I guess it was me. There were so many episodes that we wrote over there that sometimes, and we all had an influence. We all influenced each other's scripts a great deal on Odyssey. We would always give each of us would give each other the scripts, and we would always write, you know, lots of stuff on each other's programs. And we would be changing things right up to and including the time where we were in the studio. So, yeah, Hidden in My Heart was fun. That was a lot of fun to do that. And it was a great, it was fun. It was a nice homage to those guys.
Okay. Before we really start talking about Odyssey itself, I know a lot of people know how Odyssey was created, but I don't think anybody's ever really heard it, how it happened from you personally. So
You mean aside from the fact that I wrote it in a book?
yeah, I guess so.
I'm kidding you. That's fine. I can talk about that if you want.
In your own words, how did Odyssey come about?
I was hired at Focus on the Family in 1986, and a friend of mine knew about Focus on the Family a lot more than I did. I'd never even actually heard of the program. I was doing a lot of writing and a lot of theater work and some television work. And as is the case in that business, you are out of work for long periods of time. But I was working in post-production at a post-production facility, and a friend of mine said, have you ever thought about writing for the radio? And I said, the radio? I didn't even know that you wrote for radio anymore. I mean, you know, are there still places to write for the radio? I thought, you know, radio was just all music. And he said, no, there's this organization called Focus on the Family, and they are looking for a writer. And I said, oh, okay. So I didn't know anything about him, and I basically just sent stuff in cold, writing samples that I had done of different things cold, and got a call from Steve Harris, who was the guy who was actually had actually placed the ad on the radio. And he came in, I came in, we hit it off, we talked a lot, and Steve was in charge of the special projects division for the broadcasting department at Focus, and he had a lot of different kinds of things that he wanted me to write. And part of it, you know, I wrote newsletters, I wrote press releases, I wrote all sorts of different things, letters.
Mostly boring stuff, huh?
Well, it wasn't that it was boring. It was kind of, you know, it was just the stuff that needs to happen in a nonprofit organization. You got to have folks who can do that stuff to keep in touch with the stations, to keep in touch with the listeners, and to, you know, to provide an avenue of feedback. And there was some creative stuff going on in there too. Anytime that they needed something creative done, they would come to us and we would do it. But one of the things they had talked about for a long time, that James Dobson had talked about for a long time, and that the folks at Focus had talked about for a long time, was doing some sort of entertainment programming. Dr. Dobson had a guest on his program who had talked about a big topic, of course, on the Focus broadcast was how bad the popular culture was and how bad of an influence it was on kids and how we had to fight against that sort of thing, which was part of Focus's mandate. And so they did that a lot, but one of the things that this particular guest, and I don't remember who it was, said, it's not enough for us to just say that it's all bad out there and don't look at any of it without providing an alternative, because the kids out there are going to be looking for an alternative, or they're going to be looking for stuff, you know, I mean, realistically, despite how much their parents can protect them, they're going to be influenced by this stuff one way or the other. So we should put stuff out there that influences them in the right way, in the Christian way. So with that in mind, basically, Doc came to Mike Trout, who was the head of broadcasting at that time, and said, we need to do something about this. And Mike turned to Steve, and Steve turned to me. And so Steve was busy with a lot of different things. So Steve and I, as fit into Steve's schedule, I worked on it a lot by myself, trying to create a radio program. And then I would go in, and we would talk to Steve. And then Steve and I would bat stuff around, and we would come up with new stuff, and we would argue, and we would fight, and we would, you know, this, that, and what we wanted it to be, and how we were going to make it work. And came up with kind of the prototype series, which was Family Portraits. And Steve had worked with a couple of other people. He worked with Chuck Bolte and with Hal Smith on a couple of radio dramas that Steve had written prior to my actually coming on board at Focus. I forgot what the first one was called. One of them was called Gone Fishing. And it was about a father and son, an adult and his father, and the relationship that they had and didn't have, and, you know, stuff like that. And it went over very, very well. And then the Focus powers that be got to the idea that, you know, this is viable. Radio drama can be viable. And we do radio really well here at Focus, so let's put our, you know, immense capabilities toward trying to produce an ongoing radio program. And Family Portraits was for the whole family. We didn't quite know who to target it for. So we did stuff for adults, and we did stuff for kids. We did stuff for the whole family to listen to. And as was Focus on the Family's kind of bent back then, everything needed to be traditional, so they kind of wanted to harken back to the grand old days of, you know, the golden age of radio and whatnot. And part of me is very sympathetic to that, but part of me was also like, yeah, we've got to be kind of future-looking too here. It can't just be the way they used to do it. We've got modern equipment here, modern technology, and modern sensibilities, and we need to kind of fuel those as well. And kids certainly aren't going to want to go sit back and listen to the Lone Ranger kind of programs. Not that there's anything wrong with those. They're very entertaining, but it's just that I doubt that kids really wanted to listen to that sort of thing.
Which is too bad.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that they would really enjoy them, but they would also find them kind of corny. And even now, you know, I mean, time marches on. I mean, even a lot of the early Odyssey stuff, you know, if you listen to it, it's kind of corny. So that's just the way things are. It's, you know, it's pertinent at the time, but then later as you grow older, you kind of go, oh, you know, that was kind of corny. But not, you know, not that there's anything wrong with that. It's fun stuff. It's fun family entertainment. And that's kind of what we wanted to do. So we set the program. The Family Portraits aired on the Focus broadcast for, I think it was 13 weeks every Monday. And that gave Doc a break, actually, from having to do a daily program, so he was happy with that. And the response was very positive. It was extremely positive. People really liked the idea of it. But we got some feedback. We wanted feedback. We got a great deal of feedback and decided to narrow the focus of the target audience to an audience that wasn't really served by a lot of different things that were going on in Christendom at that point, which was sort of the tween years, the 9 to 12 year old group. There was a lot of stuff for little kids, a lot of stuff for basic elementary kids, but there wasn't, and there was stuff for high schoolers, because high schoolers were always the big at-risk group, but there wasn't a lot of stuff for that age, that pre-junior high, junior high age, and so we sort of focused on that age group and started filling that void. And then everybody else, you know, their younger brothers and sisters, that caught on with when Odyssey started, and then their younger brothers and sisters started listening, and then their older brothers and sisters and their parents started listening. So we really kind of went back to it being a whole family program anyway. So that was kind of the basics of it. It took a while. We started in 1987 with Family Portraits, and we did 13 weeks. So we had, and then Odyssey. Odyssey USA, which was originally what it was called, premiered at the end of, I think it was the end of October. It may have been November of that same year. So we had, you know, what, from March until October, which is not a lot of time when you're trying to launch a program. But it was, you know, at that point, it was like constant. What are we going to do? How are we going to revamp this? What is it going to be like? And who are the characters going to be? Because very, very little remained of Family Portraits from Family Portraits into Odyssey, except for like the town and Wit, basically, and nothing else kind of remained. I think most everything else was thrown out. We started over again.
Okay. Tosh, you want to read the next question?
Okay. Did you have any idea that the show would go on for so long?
No. We didn't have an idea that it would go on this long at all. Whenever you're planning a show, whenever you're doing things like this, a series that's an ongoing series, weekly series, you want to try to develop it as much of a backstory as you possibly can for the characters and for the story, the show itself, so that way it can have a long life. In television, you know, they're hoping they get five seasons, five really good seasons. If you get five seasons, then you're in the money. You're making money in syndication and in other places. The model's kind of changed because we've got DVDs now and we've got all sorts of different things, and so they're making money all the time on those things. But back when we were doing this, syndication was still a big thing, and so you wanted to get five seasons, and so we thought, well, if we can apply that model to radio, then we'll be doing really well. But nobody in the radio industry, and nobody even in the radio in the broadcasting department of Focus, thought that we could do this on a weekly basis. They thought we had to do it on a daily basis to build any kind of an audience. They thought we're going to have to put this on every day, and we immediately said that's impossible. You're going to have to hire an enormous staff of writers and producers to be able to get anything of quality that doesn't sound like a soap opera. And we don't want this to sound like a soap opera. Yes, soap operas do that, but if you notice, soap operas do a lot of repetition and a lot of drawn out storylines and things, and they're soap operas for a reason. You know, they may be somewhat compelling, but to a certain portion of the population, but they don't, you know, they aren't taken seriously, you know, not really. And, I mean, I'm going to hear from a lot of soap opera fans who disagree, but but for the most part, you know, they're on in the daytime, and they're sort of escapist things, which most entertainment is. But to take, you know, to take these eternal truths that we're dealing with in the Christian realm, and to try to turn them into a soap opera seemed to not give it its due. And I told them from the beginning, doing one a week is going to be really hard. I mean, a television season is 26 episodes. That's a year, and then they take time off. And even nowadays, that model has changed too, where they'll do 13 and then take 13 weeks off and they'll do 13 more. It depends on the channel, but and on the show. But the networks still kind of follow the 26 episode season model, and you know, you can come up with some really good stuff in 26 weeks. You're burned out at the end, and you gotta, as writers and producers, you've gotta kind of fill the tank up again and figure out what you're gonna do. And it was Steve and I at first, and then, like I said, Steve had other projects that he was also working on at the time, so he couldn't devote as much time to it as he wanted to and as it needed to happen. And so we had to bring in Paul McCusker and Chuck Bolte. Paul came, I think Chuck was hired first, and then Chuck brought Paul in. And so he and I wrote all of it for like 5 years. I mean, just the two of us. And then we had Bob Luttrell came in as one of the production engineers, because Bob had a lot of experience doing radio drama. And we kind of needed to have somebody there. But Bob was sort of old school too, and he learned a lot of stuff about the new way of doing things. But Bob had produced Heartbeat Theater, which was on for a really long time. And then Dave Arnold came on too. And for the longest time, I think it was like 5 years, it was just Dave and Bob on the production side and Paul and me on the writing side and the directing side. And Chuck would occasionally direct an episode, and then Steve would occasionally direct an episode too, but then Steve kind of left focus and started his own business. And then it was just really, really the four of us for the longest time. It seemed like forever. It probably actually wasn't that long, but we were trying to get people in. We really were trying to get some folks in to help, you know, help with the writing load and everything, but we quickly found out, what was interesting to us is that we quickly found out that this is a really specialized type of writing. It's not easy to do, and it's not easy to, even if you have a great deal of experience writing in television and episodic television, and you're used to hard and fast deadlines, writing for radio is really, and doing it well is really, really hard. It's not an easy task, and it really colors your writing for everything else that you do. I mean, I do a lot of video writing now, and I find myself having to get out of the radio writing mode in order to write for video. So and then when I go back to writing for radio, I have to get back into the radio mind frame. So it's really kind of a specialized thing, and that's why we couldn't really find a lot of writers to be able to do that. But no, we didn't expect it to go on as long as it has at all. That was a really big surprise. But I think it was just the perseverance of focus on the family. They really wanted to make sure that this thing caught on. It did catch on, and there's, you know, as long as people are going to listen to it and it's still popular, they're going to keep producing it.
Well, I'm sure everybody really appreciates all that you and the rest of the team did. Otherwise, we wouldn't have it today.
Well, we had a good time doing it. At the time, it seemed like that it was the memories that I have of it are wonderful memories. Very creative, very creative time period. And then there are some every once in a while, kind of like when you remember a bad dream. There's kind of like the bad part about it too. I mean, I don't want to say that it was just terrible. It wasn't. It was a really, really wonderful time. It was a very creative time, and it was really great to be around creative people on both the production and the writing side. We had our differences about things. That's no secret, but I think that's what makes the program strong. I think that's what makes any program strong. That process of, you know, iron sharpening iron, as it says in the scripture, that process can be very frustrating, but it can also... It results in a really good product, I think. And I think that most of what we have done, what we did in Odyssey and in those early years has survived the test of time. And most of it, we tried very hard to not make it a program of its time. We didn't want to make it so that... you know, you really couldn't play it for your kids when you have kids. You know, people who grew up on it, we wanted them to go, you know, this was a good program back when I was there. And yeah, technology may have changed so that we have better delivery systems, but the scripts themselves and the characters and even a lot of the production that went on in there is still very, very good and can survive the test of time and get kids involved with it. My son was born when the first year Odyssey went on the air in 86. And so I had no idea that I was going to be writing a show that when he turned 9, 10, and 11, and 12 years old, he would really be into. And I didn't think the show would be on the air for him to be on, you know, to be enjoying it that long. And sure enough, I mean, the show surpassed him. He went right through that age and loved every show that he could get his hand. He just ate it up. And they came in and talked to me about it. I was like, what? Well, what's going on with this character? And how come you're doing that? What happened here? You know, it would be really good if you did this and this and this. And how come he asked all the same questions that most people ask me all the time? Is, well, in this episode, this happened. But in this episode, this happened. How come that this isn't the same thing? So I get those questions a lot. So, and I just had to get them from my own son at some point. So.
Well, speaking of the characters, one of the most controversial characters in Odyssey was probably Officer David Harley.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the questions we have here is, was Officer Harley modeled after Barney Fife from the Andy Griffith Show, or was that unintentional?
I don't think that he was consciously modeled after Barney Fife. He was much more goofy, actually, than Barney Fife was. If you really look at the old Andy Griffith shows, they're really wonderful. And, you know, you talk about something that stands the test of time. Those are really, really good shows. Barney is a comical character, and Barney is kind of an inept deputy sheriff. But Barney is still, he plays it, especially the way Don Knotts played him, he played him very seriously. He was not a character that was meant to be wholly comical. In fact, some of the most serious moments in the Andy Griffith Show were moments that the character of Barney Fife got involved in, and they were very good. They were extremely good, and we never really had a chance to explore that side of Officer Harley's character. We kind of tried, but we never had a chance to do that. And one reason that we never had a chance to do that was because, first of all, the vocal characterization, which was at this point, I think it's no secret, it was Will Ryan. Was very cartoony, and Will is a very funny guy, and Will played that up, and that just fed us as the writers to go, you know what, we're gonna get as much comic mileage out of this as we possibly can. Had no idea it would be as controversial as it did. Maybe that's surprising to people. I had no idea that people would really take it that seriously. The idea that you know, for us to have made an officer of the law, a comical character, was just really rankling a lot of people. And I think we were really, I know I was. I was really kind of surprised by all that. I was like, well, what? Really? I mean, it's just a little small town, so it's not like there's going to be a humongous crime wave here. And Officer Harley was never inept when he did his job, when he was actually fulfilling his duties. It was just that he had this kind of quirky personality, and you know, we played off of the quirkiness of it. But boy, people really disliked it at that point. They did not like that at all. So I don't think we consciously said, okay, we're going to try to do a Barney Fife thing. I think some elements of Barney Fife maybe crept into him, but they're really kind of two different characters if you look at them closely. If you listen to what the early Officer Harleys, if you can ever find them again, and you listen to what we did with Officer Harley, and then you go and watch an Andy Griffith show, they're really kind of two different characters, I think.
Okay. All right, Tosh, I think it's your turn.
Okay, you wrote and directed the Odyssey episode, The Return of Harley, in which the character Officer David Harley returned to Odyssey. At the time you wrote this episode, many of the previous Harley episodes had been redone to remove his character from Odyssey's community.
Continuity.
Whatever. I can't read that far. So how did this episode actually get approved, and did you write it with the expectation that it would be locked in the vault and never be heard again as soon as it aired once?
Yeah, we kind of did. Because of the negative impact, you know, I say really negative impact. The statistics that I heard was that we had, when we asked people about Officer Harley, we had 20 negative responses. 20 people had written in and said that we really disliked this character. And at that point in the program, we had a fairly sizable audience, but like I said, only 20 people had written in and said, we really hate this character, it shouldn't be on here. And we had like 400 or 500 responses that said, we love Harley, keep him on. And because of the way that the way you look at these things statistically, and the way certainly the attitude of focus at that point, which went right to the top, I think even Dr. Dobson said this, was that one negative response carries the weight of 20 or 25 or 30 positive responses. That sort of put the nail in Harley's coffin, as it were. And so we knew that we weren't going to be able to keep him as a police officer. I mean, he was kind of reincarnated as Harlow Doyle. But we knew we weren't going to be able to keep him. We knew we were going to have to get him off of the show. And so he had disappeared for a while. We didn't put him in several episodes. And then we thought, well, can't we just do a final farewell? Let's just see if we can, you know, we can get him back and maybe redeem him. Maybe try to redeem him once, so that way we can sneak him back in on occasion and see if that'll work. And so we wrote him, and we still kind of kept the essence of his character, toned down the comic goofiness and the dumbness as much as we possibly could, made him do real good detective work in this thing, but he was still Officer Harley. And he still had the Officer Harley voice, and he still had the Officer Harley, you know, vocal mannerisms. And and because of that, you know, we wrote the episodes and directed the episodes as though they could be a farewell if we could never bring Officer Harley back. And sure enough, we got word from on high. I thought I told you that this character was supposed to go away. And so when the owner of the company, you know, says, I thought I told you that I didn't want to hear this character anymore, then you say, okay, well, you'll never hear that character again. So that's sort of what happened.
So what was the response to the episode? Did people like it that he came back?
Yeah. I mean, they liked that he came back, but I think, again, those same folks who didn't like him were like, why, you know, why is he still here? So we just sort of said, okay, you know what? That's fine. We'll move on. It was sort of his epitaph, and we were very happy that we were able to get some closure as far as his character was concerned. And then try to go on and take some of those elements and make a new character that wasn't a character of authority, but still could do funny and goofy things. And we could even be more goofy with him then, because he was a, you know, goofball private detective. He didn't have any authority at all in the town.
Yeah. Okay. Now here comes another question about another controversial thing that happened in Odyssey. Because in 1999, you guys started doing the split episodes. And one of the questions we got from somebody, looking back, how do you feel about the Adventures in Odyssey split episodes you produced back in 1999? Are they unfairly criticized?
I think they are. What you have to understand about the split episodes is that the program was going through a transitional phase at that point. It went through several of them. I mean, when you have a program that's been on the air for 20 plus years, nearly 30 years, it's going to go through a lot of different transitional phases. And at that point, the pioneer team that had been doing Odyssey, we'd been doing it for a long time, and we were getting burned out. We were really getting to the point where we couldn't do a lot of stuff anymore. We needed to, each of us needed to go off and pursue some other sort of creative ventures, so that way we could get back to what we needed to do with Odyssey. And we still face the same problem of who's going to write this program. The program still needed to be written, and the program still needed to be produced. And at that point, I was also working on Jungle Jam and Friends, the radio show. And I was convinced, and still remain convinced, that the best way to train writers to do the sort of writing that we needed them to do was to do short form first and then have them graduate into longer form. And that was the whole theory behind doing the split episodes. We had to figure out a way to train writers quickly and get them up to speed so they could handle long-form radio drama, long-form meaning about a half an hour, instead of, you know, 11 minutes or a sketch or 2 minutes or whatever. That's why we did those little interstitial things, too, the fun little David and Goliath things and the baseball thing, all those kinds of little things. Because it wasn't fair to the new writers to just dump them into this, you know, world and have them try to figure out how to do specialized writing. Because what was happening was I was doing all the show running at that point, so all the scripts were coming to me, and for the new writers, all the scripts were coming to me, and I was looking at them going, this just doesn't work. It's not working. these shows aren't working, and the reason they're working is because these folks don't understand what we're doing here yet. It's nothing to take away from them. They were all talented people, but they just still didn't understand how this works, how radio drama works, and what was going to happen, and you know what had to happen in radio drama. So I was ending up taking a lot of what they wrote and just having to rewrite it completely in order to make it work. And I thought this is not fair to them. It's not fair to the writers because they're very excited about their ideas, and then when they hear what their ideas have become. After the rewrite, they're very disappointed. They're very discouraged, and a lot of them are saying, "Well, I just don't think I can get this. I don't think I can do this." So I was trying to figure out how at that point, Al Jansen was the executive producer of the program, and he came in and said, "How are we going to do this?" And I said, "I think we have to do split episodes. I think we have to give these folks a training ground, an on-the-job training ground, to be able to get them up to speed in writing for drama, for radio drama specifically." And Jungle Jam was a very, very good training ground, for us to do short form radio drama. And so I said, let's see what we can do with Odyssey in that respect. We can still introduce new things, just introduce them in short form instead of long form. And I think that, you know, a lot of people don't give those episodes a fair chance. Yeah, they're not what Odyssey was. Prior to that, and they're not what Odyssey now is, which is really seasonal arc programs more than anything else, which we didn't do hardly any of those things at the very beginning, but the show has become that, and that's just kind of the way sort of writing has gone. But I thought, you know, here's a way for us to train these writers. You know, Kathy Wiering at that point, and John Beebe at that point, and all these different people who were coming in. Marshall Younger had been on the program, so he knew. So we were ready to say to Marshall, "Go ahead, you can write the long form stuff because you know how to do that." But these other folks have to be trained in some way, and so that's kind of where those episodes came about. And I think actually, I think those episodes are actually fine episodes. I know that they don't match anything else that's on Odyssey, but I think that if there had not been such an upheaval at that point, that people would have gotten used to them. And the other thing that we were also thinking of at that point, that I don't know if this has ever come out in any kind of conversations, but we were also thinking of how can we spin this program off? When a program has been on was on for as long as Odyssey was and had been as successful with the audience as long as Odyssey had been, it was amazing that we had not done a spinoff program. And so I was really talking a lot with some of the vice presidents at Focus at that point and with Al Jansen at that point and a lot of people to say, what can we do? How can we take this and spin it off? Because we're handling stuff. We had been handling subject matter that... handling it in a way that probably was maybe outside of our target audience range anyway. And so I thought, you know what, let's take Connie and Eugene and send them off to college. Let's take Katrina and, you know, Eugene and Connie and all that stuff. And this was all during the interim Hal Smith trying to find a replacement for Wit part two. So, let's take them and let's spin the program off and send them off to college, and we'll do stuff for college age, for high school and college age kids in a separate program, still in the town of Odyssey, but just call it, you know, something else. And then also we can kind of go back to, we can take Odyssey and maybe skew it younger too. And so some of those split episodes were sort of done with that mind frame as well. It was an experiment, and I think those programs are fine. I know a lot of other people don't, but. Oh, well, to each his own.
Yeah, well, some of them were probably... I think some people didn't like it because there wasn't much character development, and some were really really cartoonish.
Yeah.
But I really liked some of the split episodes, like the Long Road Home with Aubrey trying to get away from the Timothy Center. I really loved that split episode.
Yeah. Yeah, I think some of them actually... guilty as charged, I think some of them were quite cartoonish, but I think also they were cartoonish in kind of the way that science fiction can be considered cartoonish. You know, there were... They were definitely influenced by a Jungle Jam mentality. I will plead guilty to that. I was doing both programs at the same time, and sometimes the sensibilities bled over. But I also think that the wonderful thing about something like Adventures in Odyssey and a program that is in a world that has been, you know, completely fabricated and created out of imagination is that you can do a lot of different things with that world. And you can do a lot of different things in that world. And so, the goldfish episode is kind of that way, and the whole telltale cat thing is kind of that way, and it can be considered to be very cartoony. But by the same token, I think that it shows that good fiction and a program that has a really solid foundation like Odyssey does still has room to do things that are experimental in that way, and can be downright silly. I mean, good grief, we did, the Twilight Zone was about a talking chicken. So we can be really silly. When the Barkley family went on vacation with the Rathbone family, that was done for no other reason than to be comical.
Well, everybody liked it.
But a lot of people liked it. I mean, when Paul wrote his War of the Worlds script from the very beginning, he came to me and said, there's really no redeeming Christian value in this show. I just like it. And so I know, but I think we can do that. We can, we can do shows that are really entertaining, and it certainly doesn't go against any Christian values. It's just that it's sheer entertainment. It's a lot of fun. And that's what I think programming should be, too. And so that's the way I look at a lot of those split episodes. They're just a lot of fun. And at the same time, we were getting writers who could write. We were training writers who could actually write the long-form stuff, which they all did later on.
Okay, Tasha, I think it's your turn. And this question is something Tasha probably wanted to know, but someone else asked this, but she really loves the character of Dr. Blackard.
Yeah, right. Just kidding. Okay. At what point did you decide definitely that, yes, Regis Blackard was dead? Was it when wrapping up Darkness Before Dawn, or later on, closer to Blackard's revenge? It seemed intentionally unclear at the time whether Regis Blackard truly had... Okay, I'm getting mixed up. Had truly died back in Darkness Before Dawn.
Well, when you create a character like Regis Blackard, you don't want to ever kill him off. that's just from a writing standpoint. Now, from a show standpoint, sometimes it's better that you do, because you just can't, you can't do anything more with them. How much more evil can the guy be, aside from making him, like Hitler or something like that, which we didn't want to do. You have a character that's richly drawn that way, and then you have an actor in Earl Bowen who can make him even so much more than you had originally designed with that wonderful voice of his. And, we all, I think, felt like Blackard just wasn't the kind of character that we really ever wanted to truly completely get rid of. However, once again, the show itself, what was going on at the time with the show, was sort of feeding into our decision making about Blackard, because Darkness Before Dawn was supposed to really kind of be the end of the program, sort of. once again, it was never going to actually end. We're never going to officially say, okay, it's over now. But I know that Paul and I, when we were working on Darkness Before Dawn, and Dave, I think, was the same way, and that was when radio theater was starting, so they were starting on some other creative ventures themselves within the focused under the Focus umbrella. We kind of looked at each other at one point and said, let's do this as though this is the end. Let's do this as though this is the climax of the whole series. And that was sort of that first, album, long form arc album, for the first of those that we could say, okay, and at the end of this, we need to wrap up some loose ends. Eugene's salvation is definitely in question. We need to wrap that up. So that became part of those episodes. And the whole idea of the Blackard story arc that had been going on for 4 or 5 years. What are we going to do with this? How is this going to work? And what would happen if we just ended the program with the devil finally being vanquished and good prevailing? And so we sort of wrote that in that light, with that in mind. Now, as it happens, the program did not end, and we kept going with it, and they kept going with it even without me. And then coming back to do the Revenge of, with Blackard's Revenge, we were trying to do another one of those relaunches of the series, sort of a revamping of the series. How is that going to be? Because Blackard's Revenge was sort of right at the beginning of all those split episodes, too. And that was part of the thinking. And so we had a bunch of new writers. I remember very clearly we had a writers' conference, and everybody came into focus and had a bunch of new writers in the room. And Marshall was there. Paul was not. Paul was in England at that point working on other things. And I don't think Dave was there either. I think Dave was also in England working on radio theater. But we had a bunch of the people in the room, and I said, here's the first episode that I want to do. Blackard comes back. And they all kind of looked at me like, oh, no, come on, what? And then I said, okay, here's how I think you want him. I want him to come back. I want him to come back in the Imagination Station. Because they were all said, yeah, but he's dead. I mean, he's dead, dead, dead. How are you going to make him come back? And I said, he's coming back in the Imagination Station. And that's when I sort of lit up around the room and said, hey, maybe that will work. That's kind of cool. How would that work? What would happen? How would that work? Which is what, when it, you know, that's when I thought, okay, you know, this is actually kind of a good idea. I think a lot of people really liked part one of that episode, but really hated part two of that episode. They just didn't buy part two, but they really liked part one. And that episode generated a lot of controversy too, because it was the idea of what is the Imagination Station actually, if it can take over somebody's life that way, if it can actually be a thing that can take over somebody's mind and life and everything. And I thought I had all the answers ready for all of those kind of criticisms. So, yeah, but that's what sin does and everything. Oh, well, are you saying the Imagination Station is sin? And, you know, and I'm like, well, okay, all right. No, I was just trying to do science fiction here. Leave me alone. So, all that's to say that, you know, part of it was we really wanted to hang on to the character of Blackard. And part of it was, you know, he was a good character and we could have a lot of fun with him. And we also really kind of consciously looked at what were the most popular episodes? What were the ones that captured everybody's attention a lot? And the Blackard saga and storyline were really some of the biggest and most, you know, the most popular programs. And so to do this relaunch, we thought, well, let's bring him back. Let's see how that can work. Let's bring him back.
And you also brought him back a little bit in Ice Slap Floor.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that was, yeah, that was just, that was kind of another, you know, backhanded thing of let's see if we can sneak him in there. but that was fun too. All that stuff was, you know, my memories of all those things are just, they were really fun. I've sort of lost any of the controversy that surrounded those things, but I know that there was a great deal of controversy that surrounded some of those bringing him back, and we kept bringing him back. And I think probably, I mean, I'm very sure it's safe to say that he's no longer going to be on the program. Maybe son of Blackard. Maybe he had a son somewhere that can come back.
Ooh, man, that would be interesting. we already have his brother.
Yes, yeah. Well, see, that was the other thing. I mean, the other thing about the character of Blackard was that we wanted to, we loved Earl Bowen so much and what he did with the character so much that we thought it's such a shame that we only bring him in every, you know, blue moon to do a Blackard character. And so we thought, how can we create a character that will use that voice? I mean, that Earl's immense acting and voice talent, and make him a semi-regular. How can we get that in there? And so that's when we sat around and said, well, what if he had a twin brother? You know, that way we can still, he's a vocal twin, but he's completely different than Regis is. And Edwin, you know, can be a flamboyant actor, you know, and that was another thing that Earl was just champing at the bit to play. And so we said, yeah, let's do that. And then, of course, with Corey Burton doing his minion, Shakespeare, his minion, that was so much fun to have the two of them play off of each other because they're so good together. So those were really fun episodes to do, and it was always just a great idea. You know, it was always great to work with Earl Bowen.
Well, sort of launching off from that topic, what was it like to work with some of the great actors from the golden age of radio and television, like Hal Smith and Parley Bear?
Well, it can't be beat. I mean, those, I, I, So many of those folks have either passed away or are passing away. You know, my childhood memories of culture that I grew up with is all disappearing because I notice this. You know, every year all those folks, another one dies or another one, you know, goes away. And so what was fantastic for me was to see the guys on that I watched when I was a kid on television, and I could actually work with them, and that was a amazing thing for me. Loved that. That was one of the best parts of the program for me completely. And the fact that they were so willing to come in and do it, because we didn't pay as much as they could make elsewhere, but they loved coming in to do this. And so it wasn't just a money thing for them. They really enjoyed the process. They enjoyed the show, and they enjoyed the atmosphere that we created in the studio. And they helped create an even better atmosphere in the studio. And so it was really, really wonderful. And, you know, being around those guys, their stories were just so much fun. I mean, in the studio, it was just a great, great experience to sit down and listen to Hal and Parley and Earl and Dave Madden and all these wonderful, wonderful actors. Kenny Mars, who just died a couple of weeks ago, tell these fantastically funny stories and great stories and touching stories about their lives and their early careers. And just to talk with them about what it was like and how much the business has changed and how much what they do has changed, and listen to them, you know, tell them how much the program meant to them and how much it touched their hearts and changed their lives too, which was really, really very gratifying. And it was so much fun to do. And my best memory of those guys, I have to tell you, and it's completely selfish and self-serving, but I'll share it anyway. Is I think I may have put this in the first edition of the first run of the guide to Odyssey, the complete guide to Adventures in Odyssey. But it was my birthday. We were about 5 years into the program, and so my wife had made this surprise birthday party for me. And I came home and I walked into our backyard, and there were all, you know, a bunch of my friends back there and her friends and everybody, yeah, surprise, surprise, surprise. And I walk around the corner of the house. We had this kind of side yard where most of the people were. And so I went in there, and then I walked around the corner where our patio was, and there was sitting Hal Smith and Parley Bear and, you know, Dave Madden and all these people. My wife had gotten a hold of these guys and said, it's his birthday. And she didn't know how, you know, and I thought, well, they're, you know, way over there. We're not on the same social strata at all. They come in and they do the program, and then that's about it. They're going to go do their own lives, and they're not really going to be. But that's when I first realized, wow, these people actually consider me to be their friend. It's not just that we work together, and it's not just that they're on the program, and it's not just that, you know, they get paid to come in and do this stuff. They actually are my friends, and they consider me to be their friend. And that's when I was extremely touched by that. That's one of my favorite memories of just having and have pictures, you know, of these guys who were icons in the business sitting in my backyard telling stories and entertaining everybody and playing the ukulele and singing, and you know, that's just like the best thing in the world.
Well, Christian A asks, this isn't a question. Okay. Well, halfway it is and halfway it isn't. Christian A says, I heard that you went to the same church as Don and Jenny Long when they were kids. Did you ever catch anything about the relationship they had off mic before they got married?
Well, actually, we didn't go to the same church. Here's how that all came about. Those kids, they knew each other before we ever hired them to be Lucy and...
Jack
and Lucy. So we had hired them, but they knew each other. I think actually we hired Donald first to do a character, and then he said, well, you know, I know this other girl, and if you're looking for people, I think his mother told us that, and so we brought them in. So they knew each other before they ever worked with us. I went to the same church as their mother, as Jenny's mother. She and I went to the same church. Because we live close by to each other, and so it was only later that we went to the same church. But that was kind of a sort of a strange thing. You talk about the longevity of Odyssey. It was very, very strange for me to go to their wedding, because I knew them when they were kids. I mean, little kids. You know, when they were 9 years old. And I thought, has the show been on the air that long that these they're actually old enough to get married? And it had. And so it was really fun to watch them grow up and grow up on the show. And you know, we never really did anything as far as a relationship. I don't think we ever did anything, at least while I was working with the program, that the two of them were actually in a relationship, the character of Jack and Lucy. But we never really did anything like that with the kids anyway. But it was just really kind of wonderful to watch them grow up and fall in love and get married. And now they have their own kids. And I still stay in touch with them on Facebook and email. And I still see Jenny's mom. I don't think she's going to the same church. I'm not going to that church anymore either. I don't think she's going to that church either. But we still all stay in touch with each other. So it was a lot of fun.
Okay, Christian A. has another question. Did you enjoy doing the Twilight Zone episodes?
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course. Those were a whole lot of fun. They were, you know, another spoof kind of thing, which was really good. But that again, that's the kind of thing that where fantasy programs can work out so well. You know, you create this world and you give it a really good foundation, and then you can do a whole lot of things with it. And those episodes were so much fun to do because they could depart from the regular, normal, daily Odyssey life that we had created, and we can go into a fantasy world to kind of make a point about, you know, drug use, or make a point about smoking, or make about whatever it is that we were trying to make a point about, whatever strange kind of incidents that we could do. And you know, that was what the original Twilight Zone episodes were all about anyway. They were really morality plays more than anything else. They were really trying to show people in ethical dilemmas or moral dilemmas and how they handle them. They just did it with fantastic and fantastical characters, sometimes science fiction, sometimes, you know, fantasy characters. And that was those were some of my favorite episodes too. I really enjoyed those.
Okay, and another one from Christian A. And he asks, "Are you a lot like Dale Jacobs?"
I suppose so. I don't have any daughters like Dale does. It was very funny to me that my daughters. The Jacobs daughters were actually Chuck Bolte's real life daughters, so I had to be careful how I wrote for them, you know. But I suppose I'm sort of like that. I mean, Dale being a newspaper guy, and I'm very, you know, I'm a writer myself, and he was a writer, and you know that whole kind of thing. He was just very enthusiastic and very curious about stuff. So I suppose I'm sort of like that in that respect. I mean, I think there was another. Somebody else had a question similar to that, which was, did I have to audition for Dale? Well, no, not really. I just started playing him. We needed somebody to run the newspaper, and so we created a character. I created Dale Jacobs, who was the editor of the Odyssey newspaper. We needed him for a script. And at that point, I mean, the kind of the dirty little secret here is with casting is that you get who you have available. And at that point, we didn't have a wide pool of people available to us. We had a lot of our acting budget was going to go to pay for the main characters who were named folks. But then the minor characters, the other characters, were just people that we had to get who were available. And I was available because I was there. So, and then the character just sort of developed after a fashion. The character just started developing. We needed another family, the Barkley family. We had played out a lot of stuff with the Barkley family and that family dynamic, and then we thought, you know what, we need another family here and see how we can play out another family dynamic, which is the Jacob family. And so we just started writing things for those families. And I think actually, I'm not quite sure if the character of Robin Jacob was actually consciously Dale's daughter from the beginning. My memory of it is that Paul had written a script that needed a character with Robin in it, and then later on we said, well, why isn't Robin Dale's daughter? Why don't we do it that way? And we said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. And so the two were kind of actually separate characters until we later on just put them in the same family. And then it was very conscious to make Aaron to give Robin a sister, because we wanted to deal with siblings. We had the Barkley family with a brother and sister, and we wanted to see what it was like to have two sisters deal with each other too. So that's kind of what we did with the Jacobs girls.
Okay. American Eagle asks, We, as Odyssey fans, know you best as Dale Jacobs. Is there another character you such as... Okay. Is there another character you specifically enjoyed... specifically enjoyed voicing?
Well, if you look in the guides, you'll see that I voiced a lot of characters. And it goes back to the previous answer, which is the idea that, you know, who's available. I always enjoyed playing the big, you know, either evil characters or the folks who are, you know, the more character-y stuff, the better. And not just because that they were the most fun, but because they were the most, I could do the most with my voice so that it didn't sound like me, which I think is what a lot of people, you know, a lot of casting directors look for that too. They want to know that, you know, you're not going to sound like you every character. There's some people in the business who are really, really good. They have one really, really good voice, but that's all they can do. They can't do anything else. And if you want that voice, that's great. But if you want to develop a stable of characters that you can actually draw from and learn how to create new voices, then you want to give yourself, you know, the opportunities to cultivate those voices. And the other thing was that a lot of it was, I had something in mind when I was writing the character. And I wasn't sure that I could get that across to an actor, to a different actor. This happens to me a lot where I'll write something and I'll have something in mind for that character. I want it to sound a certain way and I don't feel like I can actually tell an actor what that is. And so I think, you know what, I'm just going to play this character because I've written the cadence in a certain way and I've got it in my head in a certain way and it's just not going to come across in the best way unless I play that character. And that sounds very egotistical, and I'm sure that there are going to be a lot of people who would dispute that, and, you know, so be it. Who am I to disagree with them? But for those kinds of characters, that's kind of my explanation for those characters. And they were a lot of fun. I mean, the characters, there were so many of them, they were a lot of fun. They're just one-off characters, goofy one-off characters where you're just, you know, sometimes it's just one line. Paul wrote a script when he wrote the script about the, he did a thing about the Ponderosa Ranch or something like that. It was a radio drama.
Oh, Over the Airwaves?
Yeah, and Over the Airwaves, and that one character where you call me names and hit me in the head. And that was so much fun to do that voice because, it was just, who are we going to get to do that? And I said, well, let me go in and try one, and they all cracked up in the studio. It's like, okay, we're keeping that one. That was fun.
You know, I can usually recognize your voice when you're on Odyssey, but I never even thought that was you playing that character.
There are a couple of them in there that are really fun. I really liked playing, for instance, I think it was Mustafa, I think, in A Name Not a Number. It was a lot of fun to play him in there because, you know, he was a bad guy and he was actually a bad guy who even turned the tables on the bad guys at that point. And, I think it was in A Name Not a Number, but, stuff like that they're always a lot of fun to play because you get to do really, really, you know, gravelly, grungy kind of characters that are nefarious and you can do really weird things. Now, see, this is not Odyssey. I just did a show recently that I wrote and that I wanted to play some characters on. It's an animated video that's coming out soon. And the character designs ended up being a lot younger. This is the difference between animation and radio. This is an animation project, and so when I wrote the script, I had described the characters and how I thought that they were supposed to look, but the character designs came back a whole lot younger than I thought I had described. So when I looked at these characters, I thought, well, these are little kids. These look like little kids, but I want to play this role. So I wrote this role. I said, I think I want to play this role. So I went to the producers and they said, okay, well, you can play the role. So we went in and we recorded it and I played it, and the director is looking at me from the booth and he says, you know, I need you to be younger. I need you to sound younger because the character designs are younger. So I younged myself up as much as I could and we recorded the rest of the show. And then last week I got an email from them saying, we want you to try to do it again. because we still need you to be even younger. And I said, okay, I'll try being younger. And I sent them back some samples of me being even younger, and I didn't hear from them. And I'm having a feeling they're just going to recast it. You know, I mean, I got a deep voice. I can't do younger. The same thing happened when we did Little Dogs on the Prairie. When we did in Little Dogs, the character of Sport, I was going to play that character, and he's a wonderful little young character, a little prairie dog. But you know, I was a middle-aged man trying to play a young kid, and that's just not going to work. You know, and so we ended up getting somebody else. So you know, the idea is that yeah, I'll give it a shot. Those are fun characters to do, and I'll give it a shot, and I hope that it works out. But if it doesn't, I understand, and the needs of the project come before my needs. So.
Okay, and another question we have is, one of the most popular. There I go again. Okay, one of the most popular episodes you've written. Someone to watch over me was based on the script that you wrote for The Twilight Zone. Could you tell us Could you tell us a little bit of what the original story was for it?
The Twilight Zone, it wasn't the original Twilight Zone, because that was done back in the 50s and 60s, and I was still a kid back then, but they had a new revamp of the series when just before Adventures in Odyssey went on the air, back in the 80s, in the early 80s. And I had written this script. I'd written a spec script for that show. And it was basically kind of what you hear in Someone to Watch Over Me. I didn't have the imagination station, but the idea behind that script was what does a paralyzed, a person who's completely paralyzed and can't even talk, what is their imagination like? And that was the first question. And then along with that, if you just kind of logically walk through all of that, you come to the conclusion that for a completely paralyzed person, their dream world is better than their, you'd think their dream world would be better than their, than you know, waking up. And they would view, in the original script, they would view anybody who woke them up as a villain. And so that's kind of what the original script was. The in the Odyssey version, as Someone to Watch Over Me, Jimmy Barkley is being chased by death. But in the original version, he's just being chased by his doctor. This guy is being chased by his doctor, and his doctor just wants to wake him up so he can give him medicine. His doctor is the villain, and at the end, you know, all he's trying to do is just wake him up. We got to wake you up so we can give you your pills. And he's like, I don't want to be woken up. I want you to just leave me alone, because, you know, in my imagination and in my dreams, I can walk, I can run, I can be anywhere and do anything. And so he's constantly running from his doctor. But you know, when I adapted it for Odyssey, we needed to make it a bit more serious. And I think that episode is certainly one of my favorites. And in no small part to the way David Griffin played Jimmy at that point. He was so convincing and so wonderful, and especially at the very end when he says, "Boy, have I got a story to tell you." And just the way, you know, he was about the same age as my son at that point, and I thought, you know, it was very emotional for me to hear him talk and to hear, you know, my son had never done anything like that, where he was, you know, where he had been in a coma or anything like that. I thank God for that. But just the idea of a father standing over a son's bedside, and they're praying for him to come out of a coma, and he's being protected from death, and he's being protected by this great angel, you know, who's been sent by God to protect him. That's just a great theme, I think.
Okay, another one. The question we got was from Tim B. Tim B. asks, what is the funniest moment that you've had in the production of Odyssey?
Wow, the funniest moment that we had in the production of Odyssey. I think the best time, there were a lot of them. I think the best time, the time that we laughed the most, was when we did the Barkley family vacation where they went to Hawaii. Because if anybody knows Chuck Bolte, he has this laugh that won't quit. And when Chuck Bolte gets amused and tickled. Everybody in the whole county knows it. And that script made him laugh. It made him laugh a lot. And so he laughed and we laughed and everybody laughed and we laughed and we laughed and we laughed. And I'm amazed we actually got the thing recorded. That was certainly one of the funniest moments in Odyssey, that we had had. Other really fun moments and funny moments were things that probably weren't recorded. My memories are kind of vague as far as specifics are concerned, but I can tell you that whenever a scene was over, whenever we would either be, you know, talking in the studio about what we wanted to do with the scene, and the people and the actors were in the studio and we were in the booth talking, or whenever a scene we'd say, okay, that's good, cut that. As soon as we said cut, either Will Ryan or Hal Smith or Walker Edmiston would start singing. They would always start singing a song, and then they would make up a song. Boom, 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 boom. They would start making up a song, and it never failed. They just started doing it every single time, and it was always amusing. It was always fun to listen to, fun to watch, and they would make up these tunes, and then they would start. Riffing, and pretty soon, you know, half an hour's gone by, and we go, okay, we got to get back to work here. But those were very, very fun moments and really good times.
Tim B. also asked, what is your favorite Odyssey episode?
My favorite Odyssey episode? That's a really tough question. I've been asked that a lot. I hesitate to say that any one episode is my favorite episode. I have a lot of favorites. Someone to Watch Over Me is my favorite. Is among my favorites. The Name Not a Number series is among my favorites. I think the Eugene's Salvation series, the Salvation Show, his was a wonderful show. That's among my favorites. So I can't really say that I have a favorite. A Tangled Web is one of my favorites, and the reason why Tangled Web is one of my favorites is because it kind of showed me what Odyssey could be. It wasn't just, you know, an older guy giving advice to younger people in his little soda shop. We could also do fantasy things, and we could make the stories have twists that you wouldn't normally think that they should have, which I really liked at the end of that episode. The first The signing of the Declaration of Independence, that one, in one of the first seasons was one of my favorite episodes because, he got hit on the head and he went back and it was all a dream, but still it kind of showed me what we could do with the show, how it didn't have to be staying in one location doing one thing. We could do history, we could do fantasy, we could deal with the human drama, we could deal with small things, we could do slice of life stuff, we could certainly deal with the drama in the town, and we could do intrigue. You know, the Blackard series is among my favorites because it was different. It was unexpected in this kind of show, you know, for us to be doing something that was seemingly that serious. And I think the whole way the Blackard series came about was fun. When Paul would write about, when Paul wrote the Apple episode, that was just a fun way to do this. It was a nice allegorical episode of being kicked out of the Garden of Eden, which was really fun. There are a lot of favorites that I have, and they're all my kids. And I don't like to talk badly about any of my kid, and I don't want to ever say that I love one kid more than I love another kid, or that one kid is my favorite kid. Because then all the other kids would get jealous.
Okay, Tim has one last question. Who is your favorite Odyssey character and why?
I think that I don't know that I have a favorite character. Officer Harley was one of my favorite characters. But I think that they all have their strengths and weaknesses. I must tell you, I was not really enamored with Connie when we first came up with her, but I think just because I didn't see much potential for her. But I think when Katie Lee was cast as Connie, she brought a dimension to Connie that all of a sudden it really opened my eyes to what the character could be. And then when Eugene came along, That dynamic really played out very well. So we got a great deal of mileage out of that. So I would have to think that Wit would probably, if I had to choose a favorite, if somebody was lining me up against a wall saying, we're going to shoot you if you don't tell us what your favorite character is, I think Wit would probably have to be my favorite character, just because, as I said in the Odyssey guide, that he so much of what he is I owe to my father. It's, you know, some of the stories and things that my father used to tell me about his childhood and everything, and about what he did in his life and how he fought in World War II. Wit's whole military service is my father's military service, and you know, from his stories of World War II and Wit's the way he handled things and some of the stuff that he would talk about in his growing up, Wit's growing up and things like that, and the dynamic that he had was a lot of it was my father. And so I think that so much of Wit is my dad that I think he would probably have to be my favorite character.
Okay, we have another question. How did the AIO 3D CD-ROM set...
Just say game.
Game. Okay, now I'm reading a long A and come. Okay. How did the AIO 3D CD-ROM game come about?
That came about because those kinds of games were really hot at that point. I mean, certainly, you know, CD-ROM games are still really hot. I guess. I mean, I don't keep up with games, so I really don't know. But that came about. We were at a they were just trying to expand the marketability of Odyssey, trying to open it up to new markets, and trying to open up what Odyssey is to where kids were, and kids were playing a lot of games. And again, I think it goes back to the whole reason that Odyssey was created in the first place, which was to try to provide an alternative to really, really awful, with some of the really graphic, bad games out there, but try to give an alternative based on characters that they already knew and were, you know, some of their favorite characters. And so that was a lot of fun to write in terms of how the whole adventure was supposed to be played out. And, what the person playing the game gets to do and has to do and how it all comes about again. That was another thing that provided ample opportunity for like twists and turns. You know, just when you think you've won the game, you realize you haven't won the game at all. You have to go back and figure out now what it is that you have to do in order to win the game, and only by the paradox of losing the game can you actually win the game. So that's the fun. That was very fun for me. I really liked that idea, and that's kind of in keeping with the paradoxical nature of some of Christian thought. You know, the greatest among you is the least among you. You're, you know, the servant is the greater. You know, stuff like that. You have to give away all your possessions to be really rich. Things like that, which are very contradictory and paradoxical. So we wanted to try to reflect some of that. That's kind of the way we approached writing a lot of Odyssey episodes too. Just the whole nature of Odyssey was this, you know, the Christian worldview to non-Christians and even to some Christians just doesn't make a lot of sense. And so that's why we're designed as creatures of faith. You have to have faith in order to be able to function. And I would go so far as to say that faith is a necessary component of being human. I don't think you can be human and not have faith, whether it's faith in science or whether it's faith in whatever. You know, from our worldview, it's faith in Jesus Christ and faith in God. From a lot of people's worldview, it's faith in science, it's faith in something else. But I think faith is a necessary component of being human, of what it means to be human.
Okay, Take It From the Top asks, what was your favorite episode you directed in Odyssey?
Oh, boy. Wow. I mean, I did a lot. I did the majority of the directing, I know, for the first 14 years. So to say that I have a favorite one, wow. I can tell you, I don't know that I have a favorite. I can tell you one of my favorite moments as a director was... when we did the episode, I don't remember the name of it, but we did the episode where Jack is worried about Jason.
About Jason opening the tunnel?
No. He's worried about Jason and Tasha.
Oh, that's a question about Tasha.
a question about Tasha. He's worried that they went off and got married and that Tasha's not a Christian. And he was really, really concerned about that. And he had this wonderful scene that that Alan Young played that was so touching. And I knew that when I wrote the scene, that it was going to be a very emotional scene because he talks about his own wife. You know, Jack Allen talks about his own wife at that point. And says, you know, does the whole deathbed confession. He doesn't know if she accepted Jesus. He doesn't know what's going to happen, you know, and he will only find out once he goes to be with the Lord himself, whether she actually accepted Jesus or not. And that's why he was so worried about what Jason was doing with Tasha. And after Alan Young played that, he hadn't read that before. We didn't do a read through for some reason. I don't know why we didn't do a read through in the studio. And he read that scene and we recorded it, and he stopped after the scene was over and he couldn't go on. He was so emotionally touched by that scene. And he actually said, guys, you got to warn me when you're going to do that from now on. And I had no idea, but that really happened to him. I had no idea. I mean, that was a similar to a moment that happened with him in his real life with his wife. And I was floored by that. it was so unbelievable and so emotional. And the emotion that you hear in that scene when you play it back, that's real. That's not acting. That's him. So, I mean, moments like that are great. And there are many of those moments, too. There were just hundreds of those kinds of moments where we would get something really wonderful on tape. And it was so much better than anything that we had actually ever written, because the actors brought so much more to it. And then to hear what Dave and Bob and you know, Mark Drury and all the other production engineers would do with it after that, that's what made Odyssey work really, really well. You know, other really fun moments were that Will Ryan must get the last word in every single scene that he's in. He must get the last word. Even if it's just a sound, he has to have the last word or sound in every single... And then Katie Lee wants that too. And so the two of them are constantly trying to figure out how... Those are my memories. They're trying to do a one-upsman of how they can get the last word or sound in the scene.
they're really acting like Connie and Eugene.
Oh, yeah. You know, well, they've known each other for years and years and years. They did Dumbo Circus together years ago, way back in the 80s. And they knew each other when they first started working together and on Odyssey. And they had known each other for a long, long time and had worked on many, many projects. And we've all since worked on many, many projects together outside of Odyssey. So it really is. I mean, Katie said this the other day. She called up the other day and she said, you know, isn't this kind of weird that we're just sort of this family and that we're... And I said, I know. I said, it's just beyond anything that I could have ever imagined. It's, you know, when you can step back, this is when the philosopher and the poet in me kind of wants to step back and step out of, you know, my own existence just to look at the life and say, that's such a wonderful aspect of life. When you're doing it, when you're involved with it, you don't really realize how wonderful it is. It's only when you step back and kind of step out of yourself and go, look at that wonderful aspect of life that you know, we were young together and we started this thing, and now years later, years and years and years later, 25 years later, we're still close and we're still family and we're still doing things. And even if it's not on the same project, we can still call each other up and have all this wonderful shared history. So that's really, really a great thing about Odyssey and about working on programs that have been around for a long time anyway.
Hey, Tasha, your turn.
Okay, watch me get mixed up on that one word. Okay, when you recorded the voice tracks for the video series, did you do an ensemble recording or did you record the actors separately?
See, you did it. Yay!
Yeah!
The initial videos that we did, when I recorded the father's part, in those videos, I was replacing somebody who they decided they didn't, he was giving them a voice that they just weren't looking for. And they weren't happy with that voice. And so I was replacing somebody else. So I did those all by myself. Everybody else had already been recorded. And so I was in a studio with the directors and I just kind of looked at what they had already animated and I was trying to match. It's very strange to try to lip sync to an animated cartoon, but if you've ever done anything like that, this is actually a common occurrence. I don't know how much you know and how much your listeners know about what happens in post-production, but in most movies that have any kind of a budget on them at all, live-action movies, the sound that's recorded when you're actually doing the scene on a location or even sometimes inside the studio is not the final sound that you hear when you watch the movie or you see it on television. They'll go back in, especially the dialogue, they'll go back in and they'll re-record it. It's called ADR, automatic dialogue replacement. And so you go back in and you lip sync. You're watching your actions or the character's actions on a screen, and you're matching. You're doing your lines and trying to match the mouth movements and the lip movements of the actor on the screen. And that's automatic dialogue replacement. By the way, Katie Lee, if you ever watch the second Indiana Jones film, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Katie Lee is the voice of the young prince in that movie. And she did that. That's what she did. She came in and she was matching her voice to him, his lip movements. So I was doing that to a cartoon. When the original Odyssey cartoons were done, the animated series, I was replacing an actor's voice, and so I was trying to lip sync an actor's trying to lip sync to a cartoon, and that's a little bit difficult to do, but they liked it, and so then we did the next ones, and then all the subsequent cartoons were all done separately too. I don't think we ever had an ensemble in the room when we did those. That's the way most of them are done these days, because a lot of even big budget animated programs and movies don't have the budget to bring actors in for a whole day because they're all these big name stars, and they're going to spend a lot of money on trying to bring all these big name stars in for one or two or three days of recording sessions. Instead, they get all their parts and they put them all down, and they're all done separately. Just one guy behind a microphone, whoever the actor is, the famous actor is, and they do it behind a microphone, and then the next actor comes in and tries to match that stuff. So that's kind of the way that works.
Okay. One of the questions we have is, why did you leave the show in 1999?
There were creative differences, and I think that the show and I needed a break from each other. And I felt like I needed to do other creative projects, and that perhaps the show was not moving in a direction that I felt like it should move into. I don't think that there was any, kind of animosity or anything like that. I just think that we kind of grew apart. The show, we sort of grew apart. We needed a break and from each other, and I think it was just sort of mutually beneficial. For us, I was having too many, what I said before about iron sharpening iron is a really good thing, but when you have too much of it, it gets to be, just draining. It can just be emotionally draining, and then you walk away and you're not satisfied with anything, and you know that the other people are not satisfied with anything, and you know that the other people are not satisfied with you. And so you kind of go, I think that maybe it's time for a break. And so that's kind of what happened. I'm the kind of person that sort of outstays my welcome sometimes in things, and the break probably should have happened a lot sooner than it did, actually. But I sort of hang on to the grim and bloody end, and I shouldn't. I should probably leave when Say, it's been a great evening. I'm going to take off now. But I think it was just time for things to separate. And then, there were a lot of other things that were happening at that point too, just with the program itself. So a lot of that played into it. I mean, we've already talked about the split episodes. I think that played into it. We talked about the Blackard stuff that happened. I think that played into it with the return of Blackard or Blackard's Revenge episode. Some of that played into it. We talked about, all those things were happening at the same time, and I also felt like at some point that I needed a new skill set. You kind of sometimes you reach that point in your life where you go, I've been doing this thing for a long time now, and I kind of have run out of tricks. I don't have any tricks left up my sleeve, and I got to go get some new tricks. I got to figure out how to get some new tricks. And so I wanted to go and examine the higher education, more graduate work, things like that, to try to get get those sort of things out of the way and you get those things going and just see what else I could do and what else was out there. With the idea in the back of my head that I would come back, that, you know, one day, hopefully, if the program is still on the air, it'd be really nice to come back and do some episodes, do some more writing and work with the team again.
Okay. A lot of people ask, will you be coming back to work on Odyssey?
I would love to work on Odyssey again in a steady way. That would be a lot of fun. Like I said, it was really fun to come back last October and to be a part of that recording session and to do actually a videotaping too. We discussed some of I don't know if I'm letting the cat out of the bag here, but we discussed a lot of the Blackard saga. We videotaped it. So that was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to be with the guys again, to meet up with them and to rekindle our friendships and our relationships. That was a lot of fun. We've since kept in touch, a great deal of touch. I would love to say that it's up to me. It's not up to me. It's really up to the guys over at Focus. It's up to the folks who are running the program there. And it's up to the economy, how that works out, from how the economy is going to work out, handle it, if they still want to do it and they feel they can handle it economically, and up to the Lord. We'll see what happens. I would love to come back. It would be a great deal of fun, I think, and I think it would be a lot of very beneficial to me. I would love to do it, and I hope it would be beneficial to the program too.